This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tonight on PBS, Bill Moyers presents the final edition of his public affairs and interview series, Now. The show itself will return next month, with current co-host David Brancaccio flying solo, but this is Moyers' last turn at the helm of the program he created. To mark that occasion, we'll hear highlights of three different conversations Terry had with Bill Moyers. But first, I'd like to offer my own take on the veteran broadcaster. Bill Moyers has ruffled a lot of feathers over the last three decades, especially from conservatives unhappy with his commentary and choice of subjects. Therefore, there might be lots of people today who are happy to see Moyers go, but I'm not one of them. This is a year in which TV news already has seen the retirement of producer Don Hewitt, the creator of 60 Minutes, and Tom Brokaw, for more than 20 years the anchor of NBC Nightly News. Now we're saying goodbye to Moyers, whose 34-year career in television included nightly news commentaries and many distinguished documentaries for CBS, and several landmark PBS series that explored weightier and more elusive subjects than TV generally tackles. These included Bill Moyers' World of Ideas, Healing in the Mind, and perhaps his most memorable, Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth. Before coming to television, Bill Moyers parlayed his journalism and divinity degrees, he's an ordained Baptist minister, into a job as a special assistant to Lyndon Johnson and then as LBJ's press secretary. After leaving the White House, he published New York's Newsday, then embarked on a long career in which he divided his efforts between CBS and PBS. I visited Moyers in his New York office earlier this week and asked the 70-year-old high-profile broadcaster, why now? I loved his answer. It wasn't because he was being forced out by any powers that be. He's very grateful for the freedom given him by public broadcasting. And he's not leaving for health reasons. He wasn't being pushed, he said. He was being pulled. He didn't know by what, but he knew he had to clear his decks to be ready for wherever life took him next. It's significant, I think, that Moyers reached this decision because he listened to his own guests. He told me of two interviews he had conducted this spring with septuagenarians, actor Hal Holbrook and the children's book author Maurice Sendak. Holbrook told him about sailing as a younger man across the Pacific, solo. What it taught him, he told Moyers, was to bend enough to nature in order to survive. Sendak, on the other hand, told Moyers a simple story about savoring the bite of a perfect peach, something you really focus on only when many more years are behind you than ahead of you. So Moyers is bending by walking away from television and prepared to savor. To savor, among other things, the autumn of his marriage to Judith Davidson Moyers, his professional and personal partner. Their 50th wedding anniversary is tomorrow, and they'll be celebrating it tonight with a family gathering at their home. Moyers, at least for now, is gone from TV. No one is irreplaceable, but many of the best people will not be replaced, and Moyers is one of them. I'll never forget his observations during the Republican National Convention of 1980. Talking about how Ronald Reagan's campaign and victory signaled a new marriage of politics and religious conservatism. Journalists have called that the story of this past election, but Moyers pegged it almost 25 years ago. He also, by conversing intelligently and enthusiastically with such people as mythologist Joseph Campbell, gave us television that was inspiring rather than demeaning, illuminating rather than ridiculing. The power of myth changed many lives and also demonstrated the power of television. As an interviewer, Moyers was such a strong force because he was well-prepared, he was passionate about his chosen subjects, and he was a careful listener. As you're about to hear, when it came to answering questions, Bill Moyers also was an excellent talker. When Terry spoke to him in 1996, the subject was his series on the Book of Genesis, one of his many programs exploring religion. Before he became a journalist, Moyers studied at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary and was ordained as a Baptist minister. Terry asked him if he ever turns to the Bible during times of crisis or doubt.
I never go to the Bible for proof text. What we used to say in seminary was the proof of the issue, that if you were having an argument with somebody, you just open the Bible and say, here, see, it says this, I told you so. I never use it that way. I was fortunate to grow up in a Baptist church that was emphasized thinking for yourself, what we call the priesthood of the believer, that you had to read the Bible and wrestle with its meanings and then bringing to bear the best teaching and the best scholarship, decide for yourself what it means. So I've never been to the Bible for that kind of, as a life raft. as a life jacket, as a pill to pop when I'm feeling down or when I'm uncertain. It's the fact that it's so woven into my whole life, and that I read these stories as mirrors, in a way, of our own individual journeys. That's what gets me about, but the exciting part of going back and talking with these stories with so many people, 38 different people in the course of this series, is that these stories speak to us today because they are so starkly human. The people in Genesis rage at one another. They rage at God. They struggle with temptation. They're jealous. They're grief-stricken. They're patient. They're conniving. They're loving. They're hateful. And the dilemmas they face are ours: sibling rivalry, family violence, infertility and surrogate parenting, parents who play favorites. I mean, I read these stories now more as reflections of the human experience in the light of a believing person than I do reading them for instruction.
You preached for a few years, I think, before entering politics and entering
journalism.
I
wouldn't call it that.
You wouldn't call it a few years. You wouldn't call it preaching.
I wouldn't call it preaching. Oh, I was pretty. I think one of the reasons I didn't pursue that is that it never came out quite right. I never felt comfortable doing it. I actually intended to teach, Terry. I wanted to. I had signed up when I finished seminary to do my PhD at the university in American civilization, and I wanted to look at religion as a phenomenon in American life. That's what I intended to do. But in seminary, yes, I went out to small churches on Sundays and inflicted my amateurish wisdom on very patient and loving congregations of mostly farmers and their spouses.
Well, I'm wondering if anybody ever came up to you and asked you for advice about what the Bible had to say about their predicament.
Well, I had a very scary experience that was a turning point also in my life. I was pastoring at a student ministry. I'd go out, my wife and I would go out on weekends, and I was in this small church. There were two sisters there, two spinster sisters. They must have been in their late 60s. And they lived with their brother on a farm not far from this church. And they were there this was only every other week I would go out. They were there. And one Sunday, they asked if they could see me after church. I must have been 20. Not quite 21. I was my second half of my sophomore year at the university. And they said to me that they admitted to me, they confessed to me, a Protestant church, but this was a confession that they'd been having incestuous relations with their brother, and they needed help. They were deeply guilt-stricken. They were deeply disturbed by this, and they needed help. And what did I have to tell them? Well, I remember mumbling and fumbling something and saying, you know, let me think about it, and I'll come back to see you. I went immediately that afternoon the next afternoon when I got back to back home, I went to a marvelous man who was a great and generous-souled minister, broad in his faith and learned in his wisdom, and talked to him. He said, Moyers, you've got no business trying to bring the Bible to bear on them. Thank God you didn't do that. I want you to go out to the university and see. And he gave me the name of a leading psychiatrist, psychologist who taught at the University School of Department of Psychology. I went out to see him, and this man said, well, I'll be glad to try to help them. It's a very serious issue. You tell them to call me. Try to get them to come see me. Bring them if they'll come with you. So the next time I went out, I went by to see them and talk to them. And I could tell that if the Bible couldn't help them, if I couldn't help them, then they didn't think psychology and psychiatry could help them. Now, this was back in the 50s when that generation of folk didn't have much use for the new psychological insights of the secular world, and they never followed through, and I realized at that moment that I wasn't equipped to help those people who hungered for some answer that I couldn't give them, for some help that I couldn't give them. So that was an occasion in which it wasn't easy to open the Bible and find something that would give them encouragement.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're paying tribute to journalist Bill Moyers, who is retiring from Daily and Weekly Deadlines after 34 years as a broadcast journalist. His programs have explored religion, politics, and dying.
I'm Bill Moyers. Like you, I don't want to think about death, especially my own. But I've realized that death is pushing through the door we try to keep so firmly shut.
Terry spoke with Moyers again in 2000 about his PBS series on death and dying. The focus wasn't just on dying. It was also on trying to live a decent life in the face of death, and on the movement to improve care at the end of life, such as new approaches to pain relief and hospice care.
You did a survey of what Americans' biggest fears of death are. What were the results you came up with?
Whatever their backgrounds, people said they most fear reaching the end of their lives hooked up to machines. They just want a gentle closure. They want a dignified death. They want not to die in a nursing home or a hospital. In fact, the survey you're referring to, I think, said that 80% of the people said they would prefer to die at home, not in a hospital or a nursing home. However, the fact of the matter is that 4 out of 5 of us will die in a hospital or a nursing home or some other institution outside our own home. That's what people fear.
Pain was one of the things that people seem to fear most about death. And pain is the subject of the second edition of your series on death and dying. I thought there were some interesting distinctions made between hospice and its approach and palliative care. Palliative care is dealing with pain within a hospital setting as opposed to a hospice setting. What are the differences you came away with between hospice and palliative care?
Well, it's a very fine difference. When you're in a hospital and doctors are either trying to save you or trying to comfort you, they bring a great deal of professional skill and training to the task. So it's institutionalized care, even if it is palliative or comfort care. Palliative care is comfort care. You know that the person can't be cured, so you will try to comfort that person as she dies. Hospice is a way of just providing human comfort. It uses very little technology, no technology. Hospice is the human touch. So is palliative care, but palliative care relies more on medicine and on... Well, let me give you an example. My own mother died last year, 1999, at the age of 91. It took her 3 very hard years to die. I'll never forget the day 3 years earlier when she literally stopped aging, in my mind, literally stopped aging and started dying. I was sitting at her bedside, her forehead wrinkled, her eyes closed, her jaw slackened, her fingers curled into a fist. I mean, the person that I had known for 60-some-odd years of my life just suddenly disappeared. I made a lot of mistakes during those 3 years. I didn't know enough about the breakthroughs in palliative care, comfort care. I mistook the inscrutability of the doctor for authority. My doctor would not give my mother enough pain control, enough pain management. I finally had to let him go and bring in another doctor. This doctor said, "Mr. Moyers, your mother's not going to make it. You should call in hospice. Hospice will make sure that she has as much comfort as is possible." The striking thing to me, Terry, here I was, a man in my early 60s, worldly, wise, traveled, experienced in government and politics, publisher of a newspaper, 30 years a broadcast journalist, and I didn't know how to take care of my mother. I didn't know about hospice. So fortunately, I called in hospice, and my mother died on the very first day, April 12th of last year, the very first day that we were filming for this series. I was interviewing Frank Ostaseski, whom you'll see in the first show, at his hospice center in San Francisco. And my wife was with me as the executive producer of the series, and she interrupted us when we were changing tapes and said, "You have a message." I went out into the hall, and she said, "Your mother's dead." Well, my mother died quietly, holding the hand of the hospice volunteer, a remarkable woman named Jenny Mahood. The last thing Jenny Mahood said to my mother in that nursing home was, "You know, Mrs. Moyers, your family really loves you." And my mother, who hadn't spoken or indicated much response over the last 3 years. A tear, says Jenny Mahood, formed on my mother's cheek and quietly crept down her cheek. And I thought, what hospice did, what Jenny Mahood did, was to provide a witness to my mother's death, a friend who was present at that moment. And that's what hospice does.
Your new series looks at, you know, many different aspects of the process of dying, emotional aspects, medical aspects. When the series was over, did you re-examine, like, your own insurance policy, your living will, your own funeral plans, things like that? Did you do, like, a tune-up in your own in your own preparations?
I started, yes. My wife and I, one of the first things we did after coming back from interviewing Dr. Bartholomew in Kansas City, who was dying when we interviewed him, was to update our health proxy, our advanced directive. Even a sophisticated and knowing man like Bill Bartholomew realized in the course of his dying that he didn't have enough care for enough coverage for hospice, and that his advanced directive, his health care proxy, his instructions to the people around him had a loophole in it that might mean, despite his wishes, efforts would be made to prolong his life. So he came up with what he called a naked, durable power of attorney, something I'd never heard of, but it makes it very explicit that, in this case, his wife, Pam, had the sole and controlling and total authority to make the decisions for him. My wife and I came back, went to the lawyer, had our advanced directives fine-tuned to that distinction, so that there's no doubt now if something happens to her or if something happens to me, the other of us has the power to make those decisions. Not the doctor, not the hospital, not even a member of our family if one of us is there. We did that. The interesting thing is, you know, death is still the last taboo. It is still very hard to talk about, even though the last time I looked, the death rate remains the same, one per person. We still don't like to talk about it. And there was a time when we'd finished the series when Judith and I were sitting on our couch in the apartment, and I said to you, you know, we have never really addressed the issue of where you want to be buried. Where do you want to be buried? An hour later, we were still discussing the issue, but we hadn't closed it. We hadn't come to that point of a declaration. Well, this is where I want to be buried. She said to me, where do you want to be buried? I have made the decision that I want to be cremated. Well, where do you want your ashes spread? Well, I don't know. So even though we have been through this experience for the last 2 years of working on this series, we still have a hard time closing the deal, so to speak.
You're trying to lead a national discussion now on the subjects of death and dying. Was death discussed in your family when you were growing up?
No, not explicitly. Death was all around. My mother lost three of her children before they were 2 years of age. My brother, my older brother, died at the age of 39 in 1966. He was just 7 years older than me. my father lost his father in the flu epidemic of 1918. Death was a constant reality in the lives of my family, and it was just there. We didn't talk about it as death. It was just talked about in terms of, well, Paul Pace died last night. My father was very active in the Little Baptist Church where I grew up in Marshall, Texas, and any time any member of the church died, the elders of the church organized themselves to provide a round-the-clock vigil for them. My father always took the 1 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the morning shift. He would go down for an hour and just sit there in the presence of the corpse, even though my father would get up at 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the morning and go to work as a truck driver. He would do that. Other men in the church did it too. Death was to be witnessed. Death was to be attended. It wasn't so much to be talked about.
What did your brother die of in 1966?
He had throat cancer. He was a heavy smoker, and he went too early.
What was it like for you to have your brother die at such a young age?
It was totally unexpected. It was like receiving a visitor death from another world. It was, you know, you don't expect your 39-year-old brother to die. You just don't expect it. You expect to grow old together. And there was a sudden loss, a sudden emptiness, a sudden disappearance from your life. And it took me a good while to come to terms with it. Now, I don't think death is ever accepted so naturally as we like to think it should be.
Well, just a few years before your brother died, you were close to one of the most traumatic deaths of the century, the assassination of JFK. I think you were even on Air Force One with the body carrying him back from Texas. That must have thrown your life into upheaval.
It did. It was one of those events that erupts that change the direction when you don't consciously change it yourself. I mean, when you come out of that experience, the road that you were on is closed and there are new roads open that you're on without even knowing that you've chosen to be on those roads. And that's what happened. I was having lunch on the 22nd of November in Austin, Texas, with the chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee and future Lieutenant Governor of Texas, and we were celebrating the very significant success of John F. Kennedy's trip to Texas. I had been down there to advance that trip at President Kennedy's request, and we saw that it was going beautifully. He'd had big response in Houston, a big response in Fort Worth, and had landed in Dallas on a blue, clear day and large crowds, and we were celebrating at lunch when we were interrupted by a phone call from the friend of mine in Austin, a manager of the local station, who said something's happened in Dallas. So I called the Secret Service, Bill Payne, who was the Secret Service agent with whom I was working, and he said there's been a shooting, and we think the president's hit. So Frank Irwin, the chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee, and I raced out to the local airport in Austin, chartered a plane, and flew to Dallas, halfway between Dallas and Austin, over Waco, Texas. Robert Trout, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the president is dead." I did land at Love Field, go on Air Force One for the swearing-in of Vice President Johnson as president, and we flew back to Washington. Mrs. Kennedy and the coffin, and Kenny O'Donnell and Larry O'Brien, all of the loyal Kennedy folks were on that plane. It was a strange time, like passing through some underwater passage that where all sound was muffled and all sight was unfocused, and there was an eerie silence on the plane. No one seemed to know how to respond or what to say. Larry O'Brien and I began to talk, and Kenny O'Donnell, who almost always never had anything to say. And I did go back once to where the coffin was, and Mrs. Kennedy was sitting there, the bloodstain still on her dress. And suddenly the world had been silenced by death and changed by death. And none of us knew at that moment what had happened, what was going to happen. All we knew was that the president was dead, and dead was real.
A lot of Americans took a day of mourning. A lot of businesses, movie theaters were closed. And, of course, family is supposed to take time to mourn and to fall apart if they need to. But as a political professional, it was your job to make sure things didn't fall apart and to keep things moving forward.
And we did. It was almost automatic. Liz Carpenter was on that plane. Jack Valeni was on that plane. Lady Bird was on that plane. The president, of course, was on that plane. And decisions started being made automatically, but always in the context of apprehension that we'd be moving too fast into that circle of grief from which Mrs. Kennedy had not yet recovered. I mean, it was the most awkward moment I can imagine a president ever being in, of having to start immediately, not by choice, but by circumstance, to make decisions, even as the widow of his slain predecessor was on that very same plane. I will always, whatever Lyndon Johnson's great outsized flaws were, I will always be in deep admiration of the sensitive way he began to be president, even as he knew in the minds of many people on that plane, he could never be president. I mean, I said to him at one he was on the phone with the Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, in Washington. We were on the phone with J. Edgar Hoover trying to get information about what the FBI knew regarding the Kennedy assassination. We were on the phone on the phone with Robert McNamara. The president was talking to a variety of people. And then there was one moment when he fell into a very obsessed silence. He was preoccupied in his own mind, and he was staring out the porthole. He had raised the shade a little bit. We were told to leave the shades down on the flight back, and we did mostly, but occasionally we would look out to see what we could see. And I found the president in his cabin looking out the porthole, and I said, Mr. President, which was awkward in itself, although it came naturally, because I think that title just goes to the man who's taken the oath. But I said, what are you thinking? And there was a long pause, and he said, are the missiles flying? And I realized he was struggling with, what was this a Soviet attack? Was our Cold War nemesis behind this? Could this be the precipitation of some conflict, some of war? Of course, we were quickly assured that it wasn't, but I was intrigued by how that played on his mind.
During Bill Moyer's long career in broadcasting, he's won more than 30 Emmy Awards, as well as 9 Peabodys. When he announced earlier this year that he'd be stepping down as host of the weekly PBS series Now with Bill Moyers, he said it wasn't that he was feeling old, but that there were things he wanted to do that are difficult to do while hosting a weekly show. One of those things is writing a book about President Lyndon Johnson, under whom Moyers served as special assistant and press secretary. Moyers' most recent appearance on Fresh Air was last May to discuss a collection of his speeches and commentaries called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. Terry asked him about a speech he gave after George W. Bush was elected the first time in the 2000 election.
I want to quote something that you wrote for a speech after President Bush was elected, and you were writing that the Eisenhower type of Republican, conservative by temperament and moderate in the use of power, is gone, replaced by zealous ideologues, and for the first time in memory of anyone alive, the entire federal government, the Congress, the executive, the judiciary, is united behind a right-wing agenda. How has that opinion of the Congress and the judiciary and the Bush administration, you know, being represented by a lot of ideologues, how does that opinion affect your approach as a journalist in terms of what is fair and what is balanced in the presentation of issues on a program?
Well, it was a prescient truth, by the way. It created quite a reaction when I said that. When I said that for the first time in anyone's lifetime alive today, we have a common ideology that's governing the three branches of government, and it would lead to certain things: a redistribution of wealth, assaults on the environment, the corporatization of government, and all of those analyses proved to be true. It is true that the Democratic Party once held hegemony over the government, controlled the White House, controlled the Congress, controlled the judiciary. That wasn't good either for the balance of power in this country, but Democrats always included a lot of liberals, a lot of conservatives, a lot of people who went with the play of the moment. This new ideological governance that we have is uniform in its outlook. It's self-protective. It has an echo chamber. So it is much harder to be a mainstream journalist today than I think it has been in a long time.
Well, do you feel an obligation to have on some of the people who you think are zealots and ideologues?
You know, I'm an old-fashioned liberal when it comes to being open and being interested in other people's ideas. I really do think, and I know this is old-fashioned, that democracy is a conversation, that we should be talking, debating, arguing about who we are, but that we should and what we want, but that but we should listen to each other. And I did the very first interview in 1980 with the leaders of the religious right, Paul Ryrick and John Loftin and Howard Phillips. I put Senator the senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch. I gave him his first interview on television after he was elected. I believe in listening to other people. So I have conservatives on. I led my show last week with Paul Gigot, who is the editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, perhaps the most powerful editorial page in America. Not because I felt obliged to have a conservative on, but because that morning he had run an editorial, very powerful editorial, saying Donald Rumsfeld should not resign. I wanted to talk to him about that. I believe in the mixture of voices. And I do that because that's a conviction with me, not because I feel obliged to do so.
You said you think that this is a difficult time to be a mainstream reporter. Do you think the meaning of mainstream has changed? And do you think that there are certain points of view that earlier in your journalistic career were considered extreme but are now considered mainstream?
Yes, I do. I think, for just take for example the fact that government policy should reflect religious values is new. The fact that we have faith-based initiatives which are taking federal dollars and putting them behind religious organizations that do not have to follow general rules and guidelines of government policy. Yeah, I think the intrusion of religion as a force in the policies of government, as opposed to being a moral agent operating on politics from outside, like Martin Luther King bringing his moral conscience to bear on the government in the civil rights movement, I think that is new. That sense of government as the enemy is foreign to me, because I was a child of the Depression, a child of the New Deal, and I really believe in public action for the public good. I believe in public resources that should not be privatized. All of that is radical to me. It's foreign to me.
Now, critics of public television say that it is part of the, quote, elite liberal media. And I'm wondering what you hear when you hear the words elite and liberal paired with media.
Well, first, I want to know who's saying it and why they're saying it. Is Rush Limbaugh saying that? Is it an adversary of public broadcasting, somebody who wants to bring public broadcasting down? I don't get that from the taxi drivers who brought me here today and said with relish in his voice that his children watch public television, he watches public television, he had NPR on. I don't get that. I get it from the enemies of public television, but I don't get it from the people who watch and listen to us. To the contrary, I think that public television and public radio enjoys a following out there of people who would not have information available to them otherwise. I don't consider myself an elitist. I'm from Marshall, Texas. My father had a fourth grade education, my mother an eighth grade education. I've been fortunate through the years to gain a position in life from which to see a lot of things that I then feel obliged to report to my viewers. And the fact of the matter is, I think the greatest travesty happening in America right now is the hollowing out of the middle class and the exploitation of the working class. And I think it's easy for the opponents, the class warriors at the top, to dismiss that kind of reporting and that kind of journalism by calling it elite popular opinion. I think that's bull, frankly.
What about the word liberal? Elite liberal media, and that's what a lot of conservative critics say about public broadcasting. I mean, you give your opinions on your show. I mean, you are liberal. So do you see that as a problem, calling public media liberal?
Well, I think that I think the right has been allowed to steal values and read their meaning into values. I think they have tainted words by besmirching them. I mean, most people in polls say they want the same kinds of things I want for our country. Does that make them liberal? I think that the most effective defamation that has occurred in America over the last 50 years has been the right wing's ability to make people wince when they hear the word liberal. But liberal, if it means Social Security, I'm for it. If it means public education, I'm for it. If it means protecting the environment, I'm for it. If that makes me liberal, it makes me liberal. But I still think of liberals as being open to the conversation of democracy and trying to be inclusive in our in our embrace of America. And I think we've got to take that word back and not run from it just because Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and Combs and Bill O'Reilly and others cast aspersions on it.
You were at the meeting in 1964 that led to the creation of public broadcasting. You write about this a little bit in your new book, Moyers on America. And this was in 1964 at the Office of Education to discuss the potential of educational TV, which became public broadcasting in 1967 after the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act. What do you remember of the mission as it was discussed in the proto-public broadcasting era back in 1964?
The mission of public broadcasting was to create an alternative channel that would be free not only of commercials, but free of commercial values, a broadcasting system that would serve the life of the mind, that would encourage the imagination, that would sponsor the performing arts, documentaries, travel. It was to be an alternative to the commercial broadcasting at that time. And I think the most important thing that we can do is to continue to treat Americans as citizens, not just consumers. If you look out and see an audience of consumers, you want to sell them something. If you look out and see an audience of citizens, you want to share something with them. And there is a difference. And I think public broadcasting, public radio, and public television have to be locked to the commitment to seeing America as a society of citizens, not as consumers. And somehow, if we accept that as our basic operative assumption, we'll find our way to serving that public in the years to come.
Now, you served as press secretary to the president during the escalation of the war in Vietnam. What were some of the things that you and President Johnson most did not want the press to find out about?
Well, the president didn't want to disclose what might be the full cost of the war, the same thing that George W. Bush is going through.
When you're talking about cost, you mean financial cost?
Yeah, the financial cost, because he feared that if he didn't think this would last very long, by the way. He thought that if he escalated the troops and made a real show of force, that Ho Chi Minh would back down, the leader of North Vietnam. I remember when the president gave a speech at Johns Hopkins University and proposed a vast Mekong Delta system for North Vietnam, if in fact it would come to the peace table. He said to some of us at the White House later that night, you know, George Meany wouldn't turn that down. That is, the president had offered a bargaining chip, and George Meany, the head of the FFL-CIO, would accept that. He thought Ho Chi Minh would accept it. We did not understand the depths of Ho Chi Minh's commitment to the unification of Vietnam. But the president thought this would be over before too long, and that he didn't want to put a price tag on it, because if he anticipated it going a long time, the conservatives would use that to cut back the spending on the domestic programming that was so important to him. He also didn't want people to know when and where he was going to be making his moves, either militarily or diplomatically. That's understandable. It's why presidents shouldn't go to war unless it's a war of necessity, not a war of choice, because you can't fight a war in a democratic way without undermining the success of the war. And if you don't fight it in a democratic way, you undermine democracy itself. So, I mean, George W. Bush has made the same tragic miscalculation that Lyndon Johnson made in Vietnam. Iraq is not Vietnam. Iraq is a desert country. Vietnam was a jungle. Iraq is an urban society. Vietnam was not. But the rhetoric is the same. The optimism is the same. The belief that we can, with military force, achieve democratic ends is the same as it was in Vietnam. And that's why if you start a war on tragic, on flawed premises, you're going to have terrible things happen. And ultimately, you're going to come to grief.
When you were press secretary during this period of the escalating war in Vietnam, and President Johnson did not want the press and the public to know what the full financial cost of the war was going to be, how did you try to prevent it from getting out?
Well, when I became press secretary, my father had a fourth grade education. A very honorable and humble man sent me a telegram in which he said, "Tell the truth if you can, but if you can't tell the truth, don't tell a lie." And I tried never to tell a lie. I would more often than not say, you know, I can't answer that right now. I'll get back to you on that when I can. My job was to try to be responsive enough to satisfy the appetite to know, but not so responsive as to give away the whole thing.
Let me quote something else from one of the speeches in your new book, Moyers on Moyers. And again, this is referring back to the period when you were press secretary for President Johnson. You write, "Iraq is not Vietnam, but war is war. Like the White House today, we didn't talk very much about what the war would cost. In the beginning, we weren't sure, and we didn't really want to know too soon anyway. We were afraid of what telling Congress and the public the true cost of the war would do to the rest of the budget, the money for education, poverty, medicine. In time, however, we had to figure it out and come clean." When and how did you come clean?
It was in the budget, I believe it was the budget process of 1967, when it became impossible to continue to spend on Vietnam and spend for the domestic priorities that were important to the president. And Kermit Gordon, the head of the budget bureau at that time, said, "You got to pay for this one way or the other, either through deficit spending or through taxes." And that was when it hit the wall. That was when the president realized he could no longer hold out trying to put a price tag on the war. Even then he tried to. I left soon after that. I remember going over to the Defense Department, crossing the Potomac, going to see Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. And I said, "Mr. President, my responsibility is the domestic side of this, and look, here what the costs are going to be. Your responsibility is the Pentagon, the Defense Department. Here are the costs you've sent over. They don't add up. They add up to far more expenditures than we have revenues coming in. We need to ask for a tax increase." And Mr. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, said, "We can't do that, Bill." He said, "If we go up to the Congress and ask for a tax increase to pay for the war in Vietnam and to pay for domestic spending, then the conservatives in Congress will cut off the spending for poverty, spending for education, the spending for Head Start. And if we aren't careful, then the liberals will vote against what we need in Vietnam." So he and the president worked out a budgeting system that continued to defer for a while the real cost. But in time, the deficit rose, inflation spiraled out of control, and the country was feeling the pain of that financial straitjacket. And that was when reality set in, and you couldn't hope or hide it any longer.
Let me quote again from one of your speeches collected in Moyers on America. And this is referring to Vietnam. "The dead were coming back in such numbers that LBJ grew morose and sometimes took to bed with the covers pulled over his eyes as if he could avoid the ghosts of young men marching around in his head." Were those ghosts marching around your bed, too?
I was never at peace with the war, even when I believed that the people who were arguing for it believed in it. Do ghosts march in my head? No. Sadness reigns and melancholy at the lives that were lost that didn't need to be lost. That whole experience convinced me that war should be in self-defense and by necessity, not by choice. But the president was melancholy. He had a depressive streak in his nature anyway, and he took the keen responsibility of suffering psychologically and emotionally for all those lives, all those people. You know, when his two sons-in-law went to Vietnam, he would go with Lucy, his youngest daughter, to the little Catholic church she belonged to. 2 o'clock in the morning, she would go with him up there for him to seek some kind of solace. He was a torn man because of this. He was a true Cold Warrior. Remember, he was in the Senate in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War, and he did believe that in the doctrine of Munich, that if you didn't draw the line against an aggressor at a certain place, then you would have to fight that aggressor later on. He also believed in the credibility of his inheritance, that Eisenhower and Kennedy had said Vietnam was important and that it had happened on his watch, that he had to put meaning behind that evaluation. But the human cost of that became unbearable to him and a source of constant sadness and despair.
Bill Moyers, speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. The final edition of Now with Bill Moyers is televised tonight on PBS. The show returns next month with a new host. As for Moyers, he told me this week he might have one more documentary series in him, a look at the fight for democracy through American history. He said he didn't know if he'd find either the energy or the funding to turn it into a reality. Here's hoping he finds both.